Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we're going to be talking about coal. Now, it is certainly true that availability and price have helped to make coal a major energy source here in the United States and also in other countries. However, there are now concerns, and not just recent concerns, but concerns about the environmental impact of coal, the impact of the environment of getting it out of the ground and then burning it. And if you couple that with falling prices for other energy forms, particularly natural gas, well, that has led some folks to argue that coal may not have a future. So the question we're going to take up this morning is, does indeed coal have a future? And we'll be talking here with two scientists and perhaps get some insight into this question of what might be done to make coal an acceptable source of energy. And we have two guests with us this morning. Masoud Rustam Abadi, he's a chemical engineer, works with the Illinois State Geological Survey. He's also adjunct professor of environmental engineering at the University of Illinois. And Scott Elrick, he is a geologist, works in the coal and petroleum geology section at the Geological Survey. And that is one of the scientific surveys that's based here on the state, one of the state surveys that's based here on the campus of the University of Illinois. There are a number of them, the Water Survey, the Natural History Survey, and they're all now part of the Prairie Research Institute. And over time, we've had a number of scientists with various surveys here, and it's always been a great resource for us, and it's a great resource for the people of the state of Illinois. So I'm really pleased that the two of them could be here. So as we talk, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief, and then the guests will do their best between them to answer your questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we have email. If you want to send your question that way, you can do that. And that address to use is will-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Well, to both of you, hey, thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
For being here.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
We appreciate it. And just to maybe as a really basic question, maybe this is a question for the geologist. One of the advantages that coal has always had is that there's plenty of it, and particularly here in the United States. And I do believe that while China is the world's biggest producer, the United States is number two. And is it true that the United States has the biggest coal reserves in the world?
I think that's right, but specifically for Illinois, as it applies to us and where we fit into that picture, we have something like 96 billion tons of coal that we could potentially extract. That doesn't mean we're going to get it out, but we could potentially get it out. And that's coal that is mineable. In other words, it's thick enough, it's not underneath the city and things like that. So to put that number kind of in perspective, if you change all of that tonnage, 96 billion tons, into BTUs, and then translate that again into the BTUs in a barrel of oil, we have the energy equivalent of all of the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait put together. It's really a staggering volume of energy that we have here.
All right. So it is a considerable potential.
Absolutely.
Energy,
but high sulfur.
But that's one of the big issues, obviously, and perhaps people would understand that. And maybe I could turn to the chemist. What exactly does that mean?
Well, first, let me say that United States has 25% of the total reserve of the coal. As you said,
a quarter of the world's coal.
Yes,
we've got.
Yes, okay. Compared to 2-3% for oil or for liquid oil.
Yeah.
I think that since you talk about the environmental issues. Let me just first say in the beginning that, and I think environmentalists probably enjoy what I'm going to say, that coal is a dirty fuel. I mean, let's agree on that. It's a dirty. And if you don't control the emissions during its combustion in a boiler, it's going to pollute air, it's going to pollute water, it's going to pollute land. But I think the question is not whether the coal is dirty or not, because that I think we all agree. We agree with environmentalists. The question is that whether we can use this vast and cheap resource of energy in this century in an environmentally acceptable manner so that everybody is happy about it. And I think that's really the question. And one of the reasons that we really have all of these pollutions right now from the coal power plants is that almost half of the coal power plants in the United States, they were built before 1978, where the first Clean Air Amendment was issued by US EPA, which means that the power plants that they were built before 1978, they are not required to have all of the pollution control equipments that make them to reduce their emissions. But a lot of these plants, not so these older plants, and they contribute to about 90% of the pollution in the United States at least. So, but right now we're in a very critical juncture because most of the power plants in the United States are about 30, 40, 50 years old. And I would say that by, you know, 2020, 2025, the utilities, they probably will build new power plants. The question is that, is it going to be coal power plants? What kind of coal power plants? Or is it going to be natural gas, which is becoming competitive from the price? US EPA passed a law last year that if there is a coal power plants to be built after 2013, that power plant has to have, in a sense that a CO2 capture process, a cost-effective CO2 capture process, so that if there is a regulations for CO2 removal, then those power plants that are built after 2013 then are ready or capture ready. In addition, in December 16th of 2011, US EPA passed additional regulations for coal power plants to limit their mercury emissions, hydrogen chloride emissions, SO3 emissions, and bunch of other things. So if you look at the power plants that are built after 1978 and those that are going to be built in the future, they are going to have a very clean set of emissions because of all of the US EPA regulations that are in place or will be in place in the future. And if you essentially look at the emissions from coal power plants since 1970 when President Nixon established the US EPA, actually the air is cleaner because of all of the pollution equipment that we have put in place for the coal power plants. But again, coal is a dirty and is a very emotional issue for a lot of people. For example, I just want to read a quote from June 11th of Time Magazine, the June 11th issue of this year, where the U.S. coal companies are finding a profitable market in China. So they are trying to ship coal from Wyoming and Montana, the Powder River Basin coal, to China, but they have to go through Pacific Northwest. And here is a quote from, so they are trying to build ports and, you know, docks and that kind of thing. So this is a directly quote from June 11th issue of Time Magazine. It says, environmentalists remain convinced that stopping coal exports to Asia is a must-win battle in the war on climate change. In a fiery speech at the Portland, Oregon protest against the proposed ports last month, environmentalist activist Robert Kennedy Jr. urged the crowd to fight back. Coal companies are coming to ship their poison so that they can poison the people in China. And that poison is coming back here. So don't let them. So there are a group that are very much against the use of any kind of coal. And of course, there are other groups that they think that the scientists and engineers who are doing studies on science of global warming and others, they think that these are all baloney science, so they don't believe in it also. So there are extreme groups on both sides. And I think that our jobs as scientists and engineers is really to provide unbiased science so that the policymakers and environmentalists and people who are for or against coal, can really get together and put all of this information on a piece of paper or on a table and, you know, act like an adult.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially what it is.
Let me, very quickly, for anybody who's just tuned in, I'd like to introduce our guest once again. Last person you heard, that's Masoud Rustam Abadi. He's a chemical engineer. And also here with us is Scott Elrick. He's a geologist. They both work at the Illinois State Geological Survey. We're talking about the future of coal as an energy source. And questions are certainly welcome. Folks are listening. You want to call in, talk with them, ask specific questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mean, I've read that same article and read some of these same things, and it's pretty interesting when you think about that obviously the people who produce coal, the industry, they're looking for a market, and the market is not here in the United States what it was. It's mostly used to generate electricity. The use of coal is declining. It's projected to decline even further. So now how serious is the industry about the idea that they would load it into big ships and send it to China or India?
And to answer that question, there's two scales or multiple scales to talk about that question. One is from the national level. But the other is for us regionally in Illinois. In Illinois, what we are sitting at is in a situation where the production of Appalachian coals has been going down and is projected to continue to do so. I'm going to get this number wrong, but I think it's something like we exported 4 million tons of coal this past year, which was a major increase, or I should say in 2011, which was a major increase over 2010. And it seems like it's likely that more of our coal will start going overseas. The two specific examples that I can bring up of this sort of changing field, if you will, this liquid environment of the combination of economics and energy use. Germany is an interesting situation where they are pushing forward the reduction or elimination of nuclear energy. And at the same time, they have reduced or eliminated any governmental support for coal production. They used to be one of the top in the world, and in the past, I believe, 10 years, their coal production has gone down by half. So what do they turn to? Potentially natural gas, but for them, that means bringing it in from Russia, which is a politically unpalatable situation because now Russia is literally controlling their energy situation. So what do they do? It is one possibility is that they will start bringing in, and they already are importing coal in, and that may be the kind of market that Illinois pushes into. So The future of coal in Illinois, there's the consumption aspect, but then there's also the production or the extraction aspect. So far, anyway, the prognostications for Illinois is that we will have increasing extraction or production. At the same time, while we may see a reduction in the actual in our internal consumption of it.
Well, I want to go back to the technology question because that seems to be the fundamental question, and ask the question: Do you think it is possible to design and build a plant that would be able to use the high sulfur coal that we have here in Illinois, use that to generate electricity, and do that in a way that we could be happy or not unhappy with its environmental impact?
Well, the short answer is yes, but I'd like to give you a long answer.
Okay.
I think that if you look at the world economy, the global economy right now, and you look at now compared to 2050, where our population is going to increase from 6 billion to about 9.5 billion. People are getting older, and the countries like, especially in Asia, they like to improve their standard of living for their people. They need access to cheap energy. I remember back in 1985, I was attending a conference in Houston, and one of the CEOs of a major oil company, he was a plenary lecturer, and he said that in this country, if we want to have our standard of life and for the United States to have its political, social, and soft power, hard power in the world, we have to have access to cheap energy. And coal is a source of cheap energy. And countries like China and India that are emerging economy, they cannot afford to use expensive source of energy because their economy is not going to boom. So it's not an issue of the United States, it's an issue of other countries. Are they going to use the coal? The second point I'd like to mention is that is about the world economy as in relation to energy and technology innovation, your question. If you look at the history of the world commerce from 1930s to now, there are only two periods where if the stock market is an index of world economy, that the stock market has done really well. The world has done really well. One period has been after the World War II, where countries in Europe, Asia, and United States, they invested lots of money to build the infrastructures. Then 1980s and 90s, where the IT revolution, the whole world was involved in fiber optics, internet. If you look at, you know, beside these two periods, we have had a very flat economy, global economy. And I think for the world economy to really lift itself, we need an innovation, and it has to be an energy innovation, technology innovation. Mm-hmm. And I think that, as I said, you look at the old power plants, the coal power plants, you know, there is no natural gas. Somebody has to come up, a group has to come up with an innovation in energy technology that lifts the world economy. And I think that innovation has to be in energy sector. And I think that coal has to be a part of this equation of innovation and technology development because it's cheap. Now, of course, natural gas is competing now, but, you know, now it's a little bit less cheaper than coal per unit of energy production. But 7-8 years ago, natural gas was about $13 per million BTU. 5 years ago, it was about $6. Now it's about $2. Coal is about maybe $1.50 or $1. Okay. I think it would be very difficult to remove coal as part of this energy innovation or technology. In fact,
to follow up on what Masood was saying, I'm stealing this phrase from Rob Finley, the director of our advanced energy unit there at the survey, and I'm sure he stole it from somebody else. When talking about energy, it is almost never an either-or situation. It's always an and. Our societal needs and world needs are so great and growing that it's always an and situation. What else can we bring to the table? Because we need it. And also to follow up another thing Masood was saying, I was doing a mental exercise this morning. Can I think of a single thing that I do or interact with that is not predicated on the concept of cheap, bountiful energy? And I can't do it. The only thing I can think of is air that I breathe, and that's it. Everything else has a transportation component, a manufacturing component that any way you slice it, cheap energy is involved in the manufacture or the existence of it. So, there's no way around it. It will be a component.
Well, I'm just curious about this this question, particularly now, of cheap gas. That 4 years ago, half the electricity generated in the U.S. came from burning coal. It's been predicted that this year will be under 40%, and by the end of the decade could be near 30%. And that it seems that it is driven both by environmental concerns about coal, but it's also the fact that the price of natural gas has come down and so many utilities are moving from coal to natural gas for both of those reasons. And the reason the price of gas has come down seems to me it's fracking. It's a procedure that also people have real environmental concerns about. But at least right at the moment, natural gas has this price advantage. Now, and again, what I've read about this, there are some people who say this is a trend we're just going to see continue into the future. But, you know, Masood, somebody here talked about the up and downs in the prices of gas. Do you think is the relative price advantage that natural gas has now, is that permanent? Or do you think that it's likely that sometime in the future that won't be dramatic?
the phrase, the only constant in life is change, comes to mind. Who knows? It's difficult to predict these things. The Marcellus Shale is the first thing that comes to mind when talking about these new shale resource, or excuse me, new natural gas resources here in the United States, and the assessment of what we can get out of that. The reserves have changed, come down by half and half again, and increased at times too as more data has become available. So, what our assessment, the assessment of how much gas we have, is a changing fluid animal. How to predict these markets? Oh boy, I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. I think it's unlikely that it will stay the same. How it changes, though, there I get to punt over to Masood, and he can weigh in. But
well, the problem with coal is that we know so much about it, but we don't know as much about the long-term use of natural gas. How is, you know, we have to transport natural gas with pipeline? What are the environmental dangers of that? So, so I think one of the negative about coal is that we know so much and we have used so much of it that we know what's wrong about it. Mm-hmm. But other sources of energies, we really don't know. I mean, natural gas, I mean, you talk about fracking, now there are environmental issues with the water contamination. And I saw something on CNN that somebody opened up his faucet and, you know,
light.
So, I mean, there are some other issues that we really still don't know. But as I mentioned, coal is going to be part of the energy equation, at least till the first half of this century, both in U.S. and I think longer in other countries, no doubt. Because, you know, in U.S. per capita, we use about 15,000 kilowatt hour per year. In China, is about 4,000. In India, is about 500. And I want to go back to use of clean technology. Now everybody is talking about the carbon capture and safe sequestration. Mm. The U.S. Department of Energy says that let's do this for existing power plant, but the cost, the increase in cost of energy should not be more than 35%. So if, assuming that if you are, let's say we are paying 10 cents per kilowatt hour, U.S. Department of Energy says that when you do all of this carbon capture sequestration, you only have to pay only 33.5 cents more, so 13.5 cents per kilowatt hour. Well, in reality, it's going to be much higher. It's going to maybe 4 cents or 5 cents or 50% more, because this 35% assumes a portion of it is 100% efficiency of the capture system, which doesn't happen. So if you translate, if I just, I have to do a mental math here. If it's going to be, let's say, 10 cents kilowatt, or let's say 3 cents per kilowatt hour increase in cost of electricity, and at 15,000 kilowatt hour per capita in the United States, if power plants retrofit their power plants with the carbon capture and sequestration, an average person in the United States has to pay $500 more per year for the use of electricity, which is a family of four is $2,000. So the economic cost is going to be a factor. In addition, another issue is that when you install the CCS or carbon capture sequestration, the water usage of power plant will increase by 90%. And water is going to be a huge issue.
In fact, China is running into those water issues at the moment where they can't expand at the rate that they were hoping to because they can't get the water to the power plants.
Well, I tell you what, I have a caller here I'd like to bring into the conversation. If it's okay, rather than make them wait, let's do that and see what sort of questions they have. And also, I want to make sure that other folks who are listening know questions are welcome. We're all getting really close already to the halfway point here. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, Champaign County. Line one. Hello.
I was specifically going to call about your assessment of coal and what it implied about sequestration and your explanation about the costs, relative costs, I think might bear some repetition because it went right past me. I obviously, you think that it's a reasonable process and at a reasonable expense, or you wouldn't have made the assessment earlier, because I presume that you think that carbon capture and greenhouse gas emission is an important dimension. I think there's some dimensions of coal that I've never had the opportunity to ask about, and we talk about all this coal that's under Illinois, but I presume that, you know, clearly you can't just turn everything upside down and scrape it off. That's basically what mountaintop removal is, I guess, blowing the top off and scraping it and not caring, and it's really an obscene part of coal. But it seems to me that there are probably geologic processes, stability of the of areas. I mean, not just subsidence, which afflicts southern Illinois somewhat, even in the area where I'm from. But it just seems to me that we have a lot of concern about aquifers, et cetera. It just seems to me that the coal seams, et cetera, have to be somewhat interrelated to that, and that I'm not confident that, given, you know, the absolute willy-nilly devastation of mountaintop removal, that other places, longwall and all of this stuff that I've heard about coal mining, that there's no real looking at these possible long-term unintended consequences.
I'm glad you asked the question, because we, in a lot of the conversation here, we've just been talking about what happens after the coal's already out of the ground, and we have a whole host of issues that have to do with getting it out of the ground. Let me get some response here from our geologist.
Sure. The extraction of coal, the mining of coal, most of the mining that is going to take place in the future in Illinois, most if not all of it, or at least an overwhelming percentage of it, will be underground mining. And we don't have the mountains to remove here, to say the least, and that is, for Illinois anyway, certainly a real positive. Surface mining, there's still some left to be done, but not even close to the quantities it used to be, and certainly as a percentage basis, it won't even be it will be a very minor component. The aspects of aquifer sensitivity, subsidence, those are all obviously very real issues and concerns. Longwall is a type of mining where you extract out something like 85% of the coal in one go, and you subside the ground on purpose with the intention of not only getting more coal, but then you don't have to deal with subsidence issues on the flip side. Something called room and pillar mining, which is both of these styles are going to be done and are being done in Illinois. The idea is that you do not subside the ground, and you try not to as well. But in many cases, when you're talking about geologic time, it's a question of when, not if. What are we going to be doing for extraction here in Illinois? Almost all of it's going to be underground. The positive aspect of that is that you're able to constrain the area of influence and effect that the surface operations of those underground mines will have. But there's no such thing as a free lunch, as there's a science fiction author, Robert Heinlein, who said that. And everything has a cost, and we have to balance it out as a society.
I hope that we get at least in part of the question of the caller. We're at the point here we need to take a short break. We'll talk some more after that. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics in the second hour. Today we will be talking with Daniel Halperin. He is an anthropologist at UNC School of Public Health. We'll talk about a book which he co-authored. The title is Tinderbox, How the West Sparked the AIDS Epidemic and How the World Can Finally Overcome It. And it takes a look at where AIDS came from, how it was that it spread in the ways that it did, in the places that it did. And they argue that, in fact, colonialism and resource exploitation in Africa had a lot to do with that. That's the next hour. Tomorrow morning, our monthly show on money management. Kevin Waspy will be our guest. He's a lecturer in finance in the U of I College of Business. Also tomorrow, we'll talk about the European Union and current concerns about its strength politically and economically. And there our guest will be John McCormick. He is professor of European Union politics at the Department of Political Science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. So that's the rest of the week. You can get the schedule on our website, will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. And we're talking in this hour of a focus about coal, the potential for coal as an energy source in the United States, in the state of Illinois. We have two guests, Scott Elrick. He is associate geologist, works in the coal and petroleum geology section of the Illinois State Geological Survey. Masood Rustam Abadi, he is a chemical engineer, also at the survey. In addition, he's an adjunct professor of environmental engineering at the U of I. Questions welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I guess, you know, when I asked the question earlier about the technology here, I really didn't add the qualification of at a competitive price.
Right.
So that's yet another thing where you say, is it technologically feasible to use coal in a way that has minimal environmental impact? It sounds like you would say, well, yes. But then the question is, okay, what's it going to cost, and what's that going to mean to the cost for the cost of energy?
Well, that's why I think major universities like University of Illinois and Illinois Geological Survey, we all have the responsibility to continue doing research on coal, because the benefit of the research is to reduce the cost. I want to give you again another example. When I bought my first house in Champaign in 1988, I had 1,800 square foot of space, and my gas furnace was about 6 foot by 6 foot by 6 foot, huge. It was built in 1950s. The second house I bought 10 years ago, it was built in 1990s, and I have 3,600 square foot of space. So I doubled my space, and my gas furnace is 2 by 3 by 4. And I pay less to heat my, I doubled my space. So the benefit of research is that not only we provide answers to policymakers, but also we develop technologies, processes, and products that reduce the cost of energy production and environmental aspect of it. Therefore, you know, I mentioned about carbon capture sequestration. You know, let's assume that U.S. Department of Energy and others, they spend $10 billion on some of the work that we are doing at Illinois and other places. Well, $10 billion is nothing compared to trillion budget of the United States. But I think it's worthwhile to spend that money to have all the answers in books in case something is going to happen that we need to act quickly. Now, I think in all of these energy innovations that we are, or technology innovation, the university has a major role to play. Number one, the major role of university is that they have to educate people who are familiar with energy, different source of energy, especially coal. And University of Illinois is not doing that. We don't have too many professors, faculties, students, research programs that are really doing that. I mean, you know, Geological Survey is really the major part of that research group right now. Number two is that it's not a matter of just burning the coal, that you need a coal scientist. You need new materials. You need better efficiency, turbine and pumps and fans. You need better catalysts. You need more of an integrated pollution control devices. All of these things are going to help us to have more efficient coal power plants that emit less, for example, CO2. For example, right now, most of our coal power plants, they operate at relatively lower pressure and temperature in a subcritical steam cycle. Now, the new power plants are going to operate at higher pressure and temperature under supercritical and ultra-supercritical steam conditions, where the efficiency of the power production is going to increase, let's say, from 31 to 35, which is currently at that level, to about 40, 45. Well, that increase in efficiency is going to decrease the CO2 emissions probably by about 7 to 10%. So there is a lot that can be done, and I think that material scientists, chemists to develop catalysts, mechanical engineers to develop sensors, for example, material scientists to develop better materials for the boilers, those are all are going to help to increase the efficiency and lower the cost of power production. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the major issues in coal power plants is that when you burn coal, because coal has mineral, 10% mineral content, the mineral content at high temperature sticks to the heat exchanger where the water flows to produce the steam. Well, they have to blow air once in a while to get all of these slags out. Well, I think some smart material scientists maybe can develop a material where we don't stick this ash on the surface. So there is a lot can be done. So it's not a matter of just understanding coal. It's you really need a whole group of scientists and engineers to work together and to develop future coal based technologies that are going to be useful.
It's fascinating what you're saying. I have a couple callers I'd like to try to get.
Sure.
People sometimes come in and they say to me, an hour, we're going to talk for an hour? Well, many things an hour is not enough. I was going to ask a question. I'll save it because I want to try to get to at least some of the folks who've called in. Let's do that. And let me go to the next person here in line. This is Seidel, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good mm-hmm. morning. Thanks for covering this topic this morning. I'd like to make two comments here, and then probably because of line noise, I'll hang up and listen to the response.
Okay.
But anyway, the comment was made that innovative technology is needed. But I find what you're doing is talking only about the supply side, and it's rather notorious that the real opportunity is on the demand side for energy uses. Efficiency improvements can be put into place. And indeed, North Urbana has a great example of that right now. The new Farm and Fleet store has a system installed whereby when clouds pass over, the lights are on. And then when those clouds pass, and I've been in the store experiencing this, a bank of lights go out all automatically. And energy usage is curtailed just by this in-place technology. So I think there are a lot of building improvements and building design features that can be exploited to reduce the demand for cooling in the summer of electricity, demand for electricity to cool in the summer, and the associated costs of heating in the winter. So I think that's the real opportunity. The other comment I'd like to make is that in this community, we're actually devoting a fair amount of attention to the unwelcome, aggressive extraction process that is proposed for this area. It pushes people around. It pushes people off the land. Even in this country, you would think that would not be happening, but it does. It should not happen in America. But it is happening, and the result is that the interests of local people, their qualitative life interests, are being commoditized, if you will, and converted to financial interests by energy companies. And people are resentful of that, and there's a lot of concern about it here, and a lot of people willing to take action to prevent being pushed around. So these are two different topics, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I'd tell you what I would say. Let's stipulate for the moment that we could make great gains in energy efficiency by using energy better. You know, if everybody went out and bought a new furnace and a new refrigerator, and we could go along and insulated their house, you know, we could go a long way to reducing our use of energy. Let's set that aside. I want to go to the second question, particularly have Scott Elwick talk about that. What about that? I mean, we still have, even if we come up with a way to use the coal, we're coming back to the issue of we got to get it out of the ground.
Absolutely. And I can't speak to the complex interactions. I mean, looking at it from 10,000 feet is one thing. Looking at it from a local level when it's your land is a totally different animal. Gosh, yeah, this has been an issue that's been going on for forever throughout the state. The interactions of those forces at work. Yeah, do we have to do a better job of those things as a society? How do we balance those things out? I don't have an answer as to this is what we must do. I think it would be silly to say that. Certainly what we would want is for the coal companies to be as sensitive as possible to these issues. You want government to be able to work with local as well, the local populace or the local people in, there on site, and then also with the coal companies, too, to make sure that they follow the rules. You have to do it as best you can. It was one of those questions, actually, I can't answer because there is no straight-up answer. It's a balancing act and something that we as a society face all the time.
Okay, let's go on to another caller here. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning. I really appreciate this conversation because it's very timely for Illinois when we see an increase in mining proposals. At the same time, we're getting all these signals nationwide that, you know, coal is dying. And I wanted to make a comment, and I wanted to follow with a question. My first comment is it's hard to hear the words cheap coal used. And I understand that that's the way the market looks at it right now, but there are so many externalities that are not brought into that equation. And I want to make the listeners aware of a report done by Paul Epstein from Harvard's Medical School that looks at the full cost accounting for the life cycle of coal, and he concludes, when you look at all the stages of the coal life cycle from extraction, transportation, processing, combustion, there's a huge cost from health impacts, global warming impacts, environmental contamination, and that if you take into account these hidden costs, that it actually doubles and triples the price of electricity from coal per kilowatt hour, which then would make wind, solar, and other renewables more economically competitive. But those costs are externalized in the market right now, and there's really an unlevel playing field right now between coal and some of these other forms of energy. So that was my comment. My question then is, there's another article I think came out in a year or two ago about this idea of peak coal, that peak coal used to be so many decades down the road, but actually, as it gets more, as the coal that's closest to the surface has already been extracted, and as it gets more expensive to mine, that we might be looking at the end of coal sooner than was ever fully realized. And I wondered if your guest could comment on that.
Let me talk to that second part first. I have heard forever that when talking about the supply of coal in the United States, the number that's always thrown out is 250-year supply. And I've always wondered where that number comes from, because that number seems to stay constant. We have a phenomenal volume sitting here just in Illinois, and a phenomenal volume worldwide. The answer to what is peak is an economic one, not necessarily the physical coal, where is it, how much. What's the cost of extracting it in relation to all these other factors? I don't know how much stock to put in a statement of peak coal, because that's such a dynamic playing field with all the other energy sources that it's hard to quantify. I think how that would play out.
Yeah. Respect to the first question, I'm not familiar with the Harvard study, but I think we should encourage people to do life cycle assessment, look at all aspects of using coal from energy and cost, so that we have all of this information so people can decide, what we cannot do. So I think it's good that people are doing this kind of studies. The second comment is that to the caller, that I think it would be very difficult to fly a 747 with wind or solar energy. We need liquid fuel. And I think that in the future, one of the technologies is going to potentially help us with coal is that instead of burning the coal, you can essentially gasify it in a much more efficient way than just burning the coal to produce, let's say, pure hydrogen, or go to fuel and chemicals like low-density jet fuel methanol, formic acid, the chemicals that we need to make fertilizer and all sort of things. So, and I think that would be part of the future of coal, that we are going to go to coal gasification rather than just burning the coal. I mean, it may not be for everybody, but I think that would be another option for use of coal in a more efficient and probably cleaner way.
I'll add on one more thing, and it's really reiterating what was said earlier. When talking about energy, rarely is it an or an either-or thing. It's always and. We are going to need every last kilowatt piece of energy that we can find as the world grows. And everything has a cost, and it's balancing those factors out.
I think, I read a study years ago that the Toyota car company in Japan has developed or is developing a car engine, an automobile engine, that the intake air is dirtier than the exhaust air. So if we put our head together and make that the goal, that let's make a coal-fired power plant where is near zero emissions and where the intake air is dirtier than the exhaust air, that could be a good goal. But to achieve that goal, then, as I said, you need, the whole group of scientists, from chemists to different kind of engineers, and environmental risk assessment, like the caller mentioned in Harvard, to address all of these issues.
We're coming to the point here, and I want to thank the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left. As we do on this program, we have this way of taking on stuff that's really much too big to talk about it, even in an hour. But I'm glad you touched on this question about how it is we use coal, because it seemed to me that the technologies that were cutting edge, or at least that we're hearing about, that pair gasification with sequestration, they do rely on taking the coal rather than just burning it like people have done for a couple thousand years, and processing it to get a burnable gas. Okay. Then that's the thing that you burn to generate the electricity. That there are still CO2 that's produced in the process, which you have to do something about. I assume that there are still waste products that you have to do something about. But does it seem to you that in fact that's the most promising direction? That is, we're going to get away from just burning the coal like we always have, and doing something like that.
Well, it's one option. For example, if we gasify the coal, you have two options. Either we can go to pure hydrogen and separate the CO2 and sequestrate it, or you can stop intermediate to produce a syngas, which is a mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide, and use different catalysts to go to chemical and fuels. So whether utilities will be interested in that option, I don't know. But I know that this is gasification is a very good option for use of Illinois coal because of its high volatile content and
One of our earlier callers would like to do a quick follow-up, and we can do that, but we'll have to be pretty quick here in Champaign County. Go ahead.
Yeah, the other point I had was on coal gasification. I understand that one of the EPAs, I don't know if it's Illinois or federal, disallowed an early move to a coal gasification plant in southern Illinois. I don't know whether it included sequestration, I suppose, since it... I'm suspicious of that as well, and the idea that we do need an expanding energy supply, which was the other thing that was just said, is not necessarily true. Conservation can turn a lot of things around, and I wish the innovation was subsidized in that regard rather than the Peabody and everyone else subsidizing and more investigation on use of coal. So. But thanks.
All right. Well, we're just about the point we have to finish up. I'm not sure what sort of a point we would like to leave people with. Do you have a last thought, Scott?
I think we covered. As you said, it's impossible to cover the totality of this field. I can quickly say, in terms of the quick answer to the last caller, Yes, absolutely. Everything, again, it's always an and. We need more efficiency. We need more energy. The scope and scale of what we're up against, you can look 30 years in the future, but you give me a problem, or you can say, well, the answer is efficiency. Well, I'll just march that clock forward. What's the story 200 years from now? Barring a science fiction solution of fusion energy or something to that effect, we're still going to face these issues, and it's better to be not pessimistic or optimistic, but realistic.
Yeah. Coal is going to be only one part of the energy mix. We need wind, we need solar, we need hydro, we need biomass, biofuels, we need oil, we need natural gas. And I think it would be difficult to remove coal from that energy mix. Efficiency is very important. I think we have to do everything we can, but also personal responsibilities. You know, in the United States, we like to have our temperature constants from summer to winter. Especially my kids, they like to be in T-shirt. But in Europe, I mean, they wear a couple of layers of wools. So I think personal responsibilities is also going to be a part of this energy mix that you're talking about.
With the apology that we've only scratched the surface, and the promise that on some future time on this radio station we'll get back to these issues. For right now, we'll have to leave it. Masoud Rustam Abadi, he's a chemical engineer. Scott Elrick, he's a geologist. They both work at the Illinois State Geological Survey. It's part of the Prairie Research Institute here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you both very much.
Thanks a bunch. You.